Nigerian author Chibundu Onozo's first U.S. novel, Welcome to Lagos, is set in her vibrant hometown. And although she's moved away for now, Lagos still has her heart.
There are things to moan about, but I think sometimes when you leave, that's when you realize there's actually a lot to celebrate. And I'm glad. I'm glad I'm a Nigerian.
Speaking of books, as the state celebrates its bicentennial, there's a new contest to name Illinois' greatest book. And State Treasurer Michael Frerichs joins us to talk about his work reuniting families with long-lost military medals. Here's one person his office has helped, Peoria's Connie Barr.
It was like getting a piece of my father back that I had lost a long time ago.
Connie Barr shares her story of learning her father received a Purple Heart for his service in World War II. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got lots to get you ready for Memorial Day weekend, including later in the hour, hearing the story of a Peoria woman learning about her father's Purple Heart Medal. We're also going to be talking about books. As the state celebrates its bicentennial, there's a new contest to name Illinois' greatest book. But first, another book. Lagos, Nigeria is one of the fastest and biggest growing cities in Africa, if not the world. And like any big metropolitan city, you meet people from all walks of life trying to make it in their own way. And it's this topic for Nigerian writer Chibundu Onozo's latest book. Lagos is, quote, the city of her birth, her dreams, her frustrations, her imagination. And it's the site of her latest novel called Welcome to Lagos. It was released in the UK last year. It's only just come out in the US. I caught up with her when she was in Chicago and spoke to her from our studios at Northwestern University in Evanston. So this is your second novel. Mm-hmm. Your first, The Spider King's Daughter, you started writing when you were 17.
Yes, that is correct.
So I always wonder with writers how hard it is if you put a lot of pressure on yourself after, especially for a second novel.
So Welcome to Lagos took longer to write, but finishing The Spider King's Daughter was so liberating because I'd been writing novels since I was 10. And I feel like from the age of 10, I took it seriously. Like at 10, I was like, I'm going to write the great Nigerian novel.
Wow.
Okay, well, maybe not that seriously, but I did, you know, take it seriously. But all these projects that I started from 10, I never finished them. So when I was 17 and I finally finished something, it was like a massive breakthrough. So with Welcome to Lagos, even though it took longer, just having done it once before gave me space.
And so there's a line that's I believe it's the last line of the acknowledgments where you say that Lagos is the city of my birth, my dreams, my frustration, my imagination. Mm-hmm. Did you set out to write this novel about Lagos from the beginning?
No, I didn't actually. So the novel starts with two soldiers who disobey an order and then they desert the army. And in my initial draft, I didn't decide that they would run away to Lagos. I knew I wanted them to run away to a big city to hide. But I didn't decide on the Nigerian city till about maybe 50 pages in. And then I thought, okay, Lagos is going to be the city. So the novel certainly grew to fill the title.
And did I read that your two main characters, mm-hmm. your initial characters, I should say, did that come from a dream you had?
Yes, it did. It sounds so cliche. And like, it's just, I feel like even when I say it, it just sounds like a lie. But it's true. I actually had a, and I don't feel like a spooky, mystical person. And I don't often write down my dreams. But yes, I did have a very vivid dream about two soldiers who disobey an order. And they're Nigerian soldiers. And you know, dream logic is a bit weird. So they're also in a medieval castle, which didn't quite make it into the novel.
That did not make it into the novel.
It didn't make it into the novel. But yeah, so then I then transplanted that to a real conflict in Nigeria. And then the story went on from there.
And there is actually a basis of historical fact of this fictional novel. Can you tell us about that?
So in the, you know, I really should know the exact year now. Because
is it around 1991?
Yeah. No. 1998, around 1998, 1999, there's a town called Odi where a similar thing happened, like what I described in the novel. Soldiers were killed and militants were blamed, and the militants were hiding in a village, and militants were freedom fighters, depending on whose perspective, obviously. And the army went in, and when the town didn't deliver up these people who had allegedly killed the soldiers. They actually leveled the town, Odi and Bayelsa State. So yes, what I describe in the book is based on a real event that happened. And then I was sort of imagining, well, what would happen if somebody had said no? And it doesn't matter what army you're in, no matter if you feel that the command is unjust, you know, you can look at this in conflicts all around the world, conflicts that America has been involved in, whatever the country, you know, soldiers sometimes have to carry out orders that they may personally believe are morally questionable. But then what happens when somebody says no? And often, even though you might agree that it's right to say no, you have to flee, you have to run away, because the consequences of disobeying are very high.
And so you have these two gentlemen, but then it very quickly grows into this sort of motley crew of a cast of characters. How did you decide to originally start with, I guess it's the original five people, and then the group grows?
Well, I guess that's part of sort of the magic of writing a novel. So, like, you know, characters and different stories just kept popping into my head. So it was natural that the first person they meet would be one of the enemy, because they're still in the field when they desert. So they meet a militant, a freedom fighter, and then another character came. And actually, so I ended up with five in the novel, but I actually at a point had about 20. And it was just chaos. It was absolute chaos. It was so difficult to keep track of all the stories. So I actually had to bump off a few characters. You know, it was very intense. I lined them up against the wall, and I said, justify your place in the book. And if you couldn't justify your place in the book, you got killed, summarily beheaded.
So who was the most painful to cut? Now
I don't like talking about earlier
the characters
drafts
that didn't make it.
Yeah, because the only version of the book that exists for the reader is the one that they hold in their hands. But I will mention, this is the one I've agreed that I will share. There was a baby. And it's a sort of literary trope / cliche to have a group cement and solidify around a baby. In movie form, it happens in three men and a little baby. So yeah, I mean,
you didn't want to do the Nigerian version of that.
But the problem with the baby is I just kept forgetting the baby. And the problem with babies is that they're incredibly high maintenance. You can't just have them off stage for like 10 chapters.
And they can't be running through all the different scenes as they're running all over the city.
Exactly. Somebody has to be feeding the baby.
Living under a bridge.
Exactly. So the baby was just too high maintenance. And sadly, the baby had to go.
My guest is Chibundo Onuzo. Her most recent book is called Welcome to Lagos. And you grew up there, and then you moved to England when you were 14?
Yes.
Was this always a city that you wanted to write about in so much detail? Because no. I think that's the other character in the book, right? Obviously, is the city.
No, it wasn't actually. So when I actually lived in Lagos, I didn't set any of my fiction in Nigeria. And I call it self-provincialization. And sometimes you can see it in children who grew up in capitals around the world, but are consuming a lot of American and or European media. So you just start feeling that the world is happening somewhere else.
Only in New York or London.
Exactly. You know, I was saying when I went to New York, I mean, I've been before, but you know, when I went on this trip, you know, I was joking with someone who was with me that I need to walk into the street and have a cab almost run me over and then say, I'm walking here, I'm walking. These images have been so disseminated all over the world. So you come to a place where you're not familiar with, but you are familiar with because you've been watching it so much. And it was the same with me. So writing in Lagos, I lived in a city with 15 million people and counting, you know, but I felt the world was happening somewhere else. So I set my fiction actually in America when I lived in Nigeria. And it was only after I moved to England, I realized that I'd come from a very interesting and complex and just complicated and very just vibrant place. And then I started setting my fiction in Nigeria.
And I do think there is something to that, though, right? When we think about all of the, there is such discussion about the Nigerian novelist and all of that now. But I also, it's a really interesting idea of expanding the idea of place, because I think so much of our literary world is very concentrated on big white cities.
Well, I mean, obviously, like, so much of our literary world where, like, you know, the literary world in Nigeria, there's a vibrant, you know, publishing industry going on in Nigeria. And this is what I'm saying about, you know, there's no center to the world. I wouldn't say the world is round. So even when, you know, you say, you know, who is which you know, not for people in Lagos, you know, their literary world does not include, I mean, I'm not saying that people don't read books set in New York or in England, in Nigeria. But what I'm saying is that there's also a vibrant, you know, local publishing scene that perhaps people in America haven't heard about. And I feel like increasingly in a more global world, you're at a disadvantage if you're not interested in what's going on outside your borders, because everybody else knows about you, but you don't know about anybody else. So you kind of have that actually information asymmetry.
That said, did you write this book specifically for an audience, whether that was inside Nigeria or out?
No, I feel when you're writing a book, the truth is there's only one audience. You are your audience. It's an audience of one. And I often tell people, with Welcome to Lagos, part of the reason why it took so long was because it was very difficult for me to get the third person narrative voice I wanted right. And I remembered I would show it to people and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm enjoying it. Yeah, this is enjoyable. But it wasn't right to me. You know, I'm a musician. So I know about you watch people when they tune. It's like everybody has their internal tuning fork. And you, somebody else might be like, no, this is fine. It's like, no. It's not on pitch to me, okay? My tuning fork is saying this is out of tune. So with Welcome to Lagos, I was my audience. It was what I wanted first before you think about a wider readership.
And to that point of tuning, I wanted to ask you about language in the book, because there are so many different languages. There's so many different versions of English. And you even talk about even that. That's also a theme of the book, the different classes in which how people communicate to each other. Was that an important part of the book for you, or did that just sort of come out?
I think it's just true to how Lagos is in real life. So Lagos is a magnet. It's an economic magnet, not just for other Nigerians. It's across West Africa and across Africa. So many people are drawn to the city. It's very cosmopolitan. And I mean, sometimes in African cities as well, not to say that there's not a European population, but you know, if you look out on the city, you might see that everybody's black and therefore then assume that, you know, this is a homogenous place. But that's very far from the case. You know, that's how it is in Lagos. You go through some places, people are speaking Yoruba, some people are speaking Pidgin in the same bus, people are speaking Igbo, people are speaking Hausa. These are Nigerian languages. People are speaking Nigerian English. You know, the radio presenters on the radio are speaking often in an American accent because that shows to some people a certain level of sophistication.
There's just so much. Like Fine Boys. So you just did, exactly. You were just doing one of the characters of the book, right?
Exactly. Yes, I have an aspiring radio presenter in the book, and he feels like, you know, to make it, he has to sound American. Exactly.
Oh, it's so interesting. So you mentioned the bus. One of my favorite scenes is in the beginning of the book, just four of them at that point, when they get on the bus, and how everyone starts praying, and they don't want the bus to go until the whole bus has taken part in this prayer. And I was so charmed by this scene, but I wanted to ask, does that happen?
It does. It does.
Can you describe this scene for people who haven't read the book?
Okay, so basically they're about to set off on probably about 8-hour bus ride. They're going by night as well. There's a phrase in Nigeria where people pray, we don't want to go out on a day where the road is hungry. Because there's an idea, like a metaphorical idea, that the road drinks blood. Because, you know, when there's an accident, blood will be spilled on the road. So they are praying that the journey is going to be fine. But then it's almost kind of like Jonah and the whale. You don't want anybody to attract any ill omen or ill or ill luck to the group. So, you know, when they pray, everybody has to say amen. Like, if you're not saying amen, maybe you're
the one that's going to cause the accident.
Exactly.
Okay. But though, there is a role of faith in this book, in this story, where it's not just a political tool, but there's also, it's a genuine moral center for many of the characters. But I wonder what you were hoping people who weren't religious maybe might take away from the portrayal of the different religion or faith that's in this book.
I mean, I wasn't thinking about people who were religious or not religious when I was writing this. I was thinking about myself. And one thing I've, you know, Toni Morrison says, you know, if you feel there's a story that hasn't been written, you know, write it yourself. And this is not to say that, you know, faith hasn't been explored in fiction before, but I just feel it's not been done often enough in a way that I've enjoyed and liked. So an example of someone who I love and whose work I admire is Marilyn Robinson. And she showed me in her fiction that you can explore faith in a way, even if you're a Christian yourself, that is not proselytizing. And I'm not saying that there's not a place for that. I love C.S. Lewis. I love his apologetic work. But that's not what I wanted to achieve in a novel. And my main character, Chike, in fact, I would describe him as an agnostic, a seeker. And so what he does is, they never go to church. They never see a pastor. They never.
But it's a very religious family that has come together. They have this evening ritual where Chike is reading the Bible to everyone. And they're all, it's a very reverent, it seems like a very reverent moment they all have together every evening.
And I feel like that goes back to a more elemental version of church. Because, you know, in places where, for example, the church is persecuted and there are no superstructures, there's no cathedral or no place where a bishop can stand up, the church still goes on because church is not building, it's people. It's individuals coming together and going on that journey of faith.
My guest is Chibundu Onozu. She's the author of Welcome to Lagos. As we're talking about this, there's also, I think, a really interesting part of the book that I think is very matter of fact, which is that there's Muslims and Christians who are living alongside each other with no, it's just sort of a very matter of fact interaction that they have on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Was that deliberate on your part?
You see, the thing is, that type of interaction never makes the news, okay? So sometimes I'll go for these interviews and they'll say, you know, Muslims and Christians in Nigeria are at war. And I'm like, you need to qualify that statement. You know, where are they at war? Definitely not in my family. So my mom used to be a Muslim, actually. She's from a Muslim family. Her father was an Alaji, which means, you know, he went on pilgrimage to Mecca. He was polygamous. He married four wives. I must add, not all at the same time. He only ever had two at once, so he wasn't a greedy man. And she converted to Christianity. She still has relatives who are Muslims. She married somebody from another ethnic group, which is my father. And it's not just, you know, tolerance. It's not actually people tolerating each other. It's like people enjoying each other's company and actually living.
Yeah, it's just life.
Yes, exactly. But that doesn't make the news. You know, what makes the news is when it erupts, when there are eruptions of violence and conflict, et cetera, et cetera.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Chibundu Onozu, author of Welcome to Lagos. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. My guest is Chibundu Onozu. She's the author of Welcome to Lagos, and we're talking about her second novel. She's actually on a tour of the U.S. She's been speaking in Chicago, which is where we're catching up with her here in Evanston. So we talked about faith and sort of just how that's a very normal thing. There's also, I think, which also seems like very normal, is the level of corruption. That's another, I think, theme of the book.
Yes. I mean, you know, see, Nigerians, you know, when we go abroad, we get very defensive.
I know. I was curious about if that was something you thought about when you were writing as a portrayal of Nigeria, too.
Yes. I mean, I wrote it because I was interested in it and I was interested in exploring the fact that, you know, corruption is not this massive superstructure run by some bogeyman.
It's kind of funny. It's a very absurdist way this sort of the whole thing plays out also, I think.
It's human beings, you know, like sometimes we make, you know, corruption seem like this thing over there that, you know, is some supernatural force. It's people. It's somebody's dad. It's somebody's mom. It's somebody's auntie and uncle. But I mean, obviously, before, I feel like as a Nigerian, a proud Nigerian, I must add, you know, corruption is not a Nigerian problem. Okay, it's a global problem. There's corruption everywhere.
You're in Illinois. This is one of the most. We have the notorious distinction of having the most governors who have ended up in prison.
Exactly. So you know where I'm. You know where I'm coming from. It's, I feel like it's not. And also, like, you know, but the Nigerian, you know, corruption is a global system. You know, this money that they're hiding, where does it go to? You know, it comes to European capitals, it comes to American capitals, it bolsters foreign property markets, but nobody wants to have that.
Right, there's a great scene where you talk about that in London, the apartment.
Yes, exactly.
The North Kensington apartment, and it made me think of that, how many places in London are basically havens for people who are storing their money.
But it's just like, oh, these Africans, why are they always stealing? It's like, why are you always colluding with us? Okay. But anyway, so yes, I mean, I did want to explore the theme of corruption, but also from a, like, an individual perspective, like what it means. Because even though the system is corrupt, human beings still have agency. Even though it's more difficult to be honest, there is still that choice and people still, you know, choose the wrong thing. So I wanted to write a little bit about individual agency.
The journalist in me was really pleased at the way journalism was portrayed in this book. I have to say, I have a normal pet peeve. I hate normally when journalists are always, I always think it's completely unrealistic the way that the story is portrayed. But that's also another really important theme of the book. One of the characters is a newspaper owner who decides to take on all of this corruption and the government, a Nigerian.
Yes, I mean, that was a very enjoyable part. I mean, some people have read it and felt that, you know, I'm being cynical and saying that, you know, if people are crusading against corruption, it's always going to end badly. And I think that's not what I'm trying to say. What I was trying to say with that character was that it's important to have these stories being told. And you can't give up if it fails the first time. And I mean, I'm not going to, you know, spoil the plot, but there's a bit of a Phoenix bit where do you continue with this journalism, with this crusading when it all goes wrong?
When you see the cost of it.
Yes, when you see the cost of it. That's what and I mean, people have, especially journalists in Nigeria, they have paid a very high price for press freedom, for the right to challenge, you know, the government. But out of their ashes, others have risen again. And I mean, his newspaper was actually based, again, on a real-life newspaper called 234 Next. And it was founded by a man called Dele Olojede, who is not my character. But he moved from America to Nigeria to found this sort of newspaper that was crusading against the government, crusading against corruption. And it didn't work. It didn't work financially. The quality of journalism was great, but they couldn't make it be profitable.
That's not a problem just in Nigeria. Okay. <I'll tell you.
laughs> But I guess what I wanted to, I mean, even if that didn't work, does that mean we're going to end crusading against corruption? Like, you have to find another. I've moved from being a cynic about Nigeria to being an optimistic realist, which is that things are difficult and that your first attempt at change might fail the first time. But we can't stop at the first attempt. I say this sitting from America, but like, just as a Nigerian, I feel like we can't stop at the first attempt.
My guest is Chibundi Onozu. She's the author of Welcome to Lagos. And I think that's a really interesting attitude for someone to have. I think oftentimes when you are born somewhere and you move, part of the immigrant experience is a romanticization of where you were, you know, and I think it's also, I think it's probably more true for older people when they've had spent their formative years somewhere else and then have moved away. And, you know, I'm thinking of my parents moving to the U.S. when they were in their 20s and 30s, as opposed to you were 14. I wonder how this book changed your relationship of how you thought about Lagos.
So we see. Lagos is a city that does not take romanticization very well. So even if you
go back to Lagos, and you don't, the book does not romanticize exactly. It at all.
I go back to Lagos at least once a year. Even if you arrive with rose-tinted glasses, after 20 minutes in the airport, your glasses will very quickly darken. They will very quickly turn into sunshades, regular sunshades. So, no, it's not a city, but it's still a city that I love. I say Lagos is like Red Bull. It gives you wings, you know, you arrive and everybody's alive. Everything is in Technicolor. So I don't think I romanticize it, but I think going away allowed me to appreciate what was so unique about Lagos. And I just feel there's nowhere like it in the world. I mean, I haven't traveled everywhere in the world, but I've been to a couple of capitals. I've been to Seoul, I've been to Johannesburg, I've been to Rio. These are all great, fantastic places. And often as a writer, you're traveling as a writer, which also is a bit of a privileged way to travel as well. But, you know, just like every proud Nigerian, there's no place like home. You know, Niger is the best.
And do you think partially this is a way of also connecting with what you lost when you left?
That's a really good question, actually. I think, yes, it's good to leave home and come back, because there are things that are better elsewhere. So, like, you know, infrastructurally, you know, roads, electricity, stuff like that. Yes, you know, there are things that are better elsewhere, but there are also things that we do in Nigeria really well. There's a national character, there's a resilience, there's confidence.
You haven't even talked about the food.
There's the food, of course, but there's a confidence with which Nigerians move through the world. And it doesn't matter, even if we go somewhere and you don't want us, the way Nigeria has raised us and schooled us and emboldened us means that we move through the world differently. You need to leave Nigeria to appreciate that. You know, you need to, like, you know, you can go to other places. Like, we're not easily cowed, you know. A Nigerian will be the first person to say, if they see someone jumping the queue, you better get behind, you know. If you walk over other people, you cannot walk over us. Sometimes you have to leave to appreciate what's so great. Because sometimes when you're there, you know, and it's not that there are not things to moan about, corruption, electricity, you know, crime, poverty, there are things to moan about. But I think sometimes when you leave, that's when you realize there's actually a lot to celebrate. And I'm glad I'm a Nigerian.
So that said, you're getting your PhD now at King's College in London, is that right?
Yes, I am.
So are you planning to go back to Nigeria one day?
Well, I mean, that's the hope. The truth is, the longer you stay away, the more difficult it is to resettle. So obviously, visiting Nigeria, I have my parents live in Nigeria. My brother lives in Nigeria. So there's no way I'll ever be, you know, cut off completely. But it's true that, you know, the longer you stay away, you know, as the Bible says, you know, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. You know, the flesh likes constant electricity. The flesh likes, I don't know, Chick-fil-A. So I love home, and I mean I don't like to stay away from Nigeria for too long. And I still, it's home. Nigeria is home.
You could read much more about this home in Welcome to Lagos. Chibundu Onozu is the author of Welcome to Lagos. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As Illinois celebrates its 200th anniversary, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum is asking people to vote on the best of Illinois in different categories, everything from movies to athletes to scenic spots. And starting this weekend, you can vote on what book you think best represents the state. The website for voting is IllinoisTop200.com. We'll have that on our website as well and tweet it out too. But joining me now to talk about these selections is Chris Wills from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum and John Hallwiss, a professor, literary scholar, and historian at Western Illinois University. Chris, John, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Chris, before we get into the list, can you tell us how you came up with these nominees?
It was basically a matter of combing through lists of great American novels and seeing which ones had Illinois and Chicago connections, seeing which authors, famous authors, came from Illinois or did major work here, and then paring down this huge list into nominees, about 18 or so, that then the voters could choose from.
Right. So there's, did I count 17 or is there 18 on this list? And I think some of them are going to be things that they're kind of immediately associated with Illinois, whether that's Native Son, of course, by Richard Wright, or The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, or Boss with Richard J. Daley, Sister Carrie, lots of some iconic, I think, Illinois and Chicago novels here. But then this is, as you said, Chris, a pretty big list. I wonder, Chris, are you allowed to say which ones are your favorite on this list?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's one of the great things about these sorts of lists is it encourages people to talk about their favorites and to discover new ones. For me, The Good War is just an amazing piece of reporting by Studs Terkel. you know, his genius with oral history is different from almost any other books about the war. So I found that really fascinating. I'm a big fan of Dandelion Wine from when I was younger and Spoon River Anthology. I think that's just an amazing collection of poems.
Right. Let's go to Dandelion Wine. That's a 1957 novel by Ray Bradbury. It takes place in the summer of 1928 in the fictional town of Greentown, Illinois, which is based on Waukegan. John, this is one of your favorites on this list too, as well, right?
Well, it's a very good book. It has some kind of science fiction aspects to it, but it's essentially about a boy and his experience in this small town, and especially coping with the idea of death in the world and the fact that things don't last forever. The past, some older people relate very closely to the past, and so it's about that whole issue of time and feeling at home in the world.
Sister Carrie's also on this list. John, can you tell us about that?
Sister Carrie is, of course, a wonderful book by Theodore Dreiser, great novelist. It's a naturalistic novel, and what we mean by, and Chicago has produced a number of those, famous for writers in that tradition, but a naturalistic work of fiction shows the impact of environment on people, their cultural situation, how much does it grind them down usually and make life difficult for them. And so Sister Carrie, about a young woman who comes to Chicago and wants to realize the American dream and, of course, has a huge struggle on her hands. So it's no wonder that was a popular book when it since it first appeared, but now it's regarded as a major American novel.
Well, and speaking of struggle and major American novels, The Jungle's also on this list. Chris, that's kind of a no-brainer for ending up on a top list of Illinois books, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it sums up such an important chapter in Chicago's history with the meatpacking industry and immigration, and it also had such an amazing impact on the nation's food safety laws. So, that's, yeah, as you say, it's just a natural to be on any list of top Illinois books.
John, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about Spoon River Anthology. I know that was another one of your favorites.
Well, it's one I've been associated with for many years and have an edition, in fact, of Spoon River Anthology that has a 100-page introduction to it and identifies who all the poems are based on also. And so, yeah, it's a book, of course, about the small town experience. If readers are interested in something that doesn't deal with Chicago, here's an iconic American book about the small town, and it's, of course, full of poetic monologues, very readable monologues. They're not especially difficult to understand, but often very engaging, compelling monologues about life and the struggle in the small town.
My favorite on this list is The House on Mongo Street. That's Sandra Cisneros' 1984 coming of age novel by the Mexican-American writer. That one, I think, is probably one of my favorite, but there's lots of others on this list. Devil in the White City, Across Five Aprils, From Here to Eternity. All of these are available for you to start voting on tomorrow. You can vote on what book you think best represents Illinois. The website for voting is IllinoisTop200.com. We will have that on our website, and we will tweet it out as well. But I want to thank Chris Wills with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and John Hallwas, a professor and literary scholar and historian at Western Illinois University, for being with me. Gentlemen, thank you.
You're sure welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This weekend, we celebrate Memorial Day, and though lots of people think of it as the start of summer and barbecues and picnics, the holiday is designed to honor those who have given their lives in military service to this country. And when we think of veterans and military awards, Purple Hearts come to mind. It's the oldest existing award given to American service members. It's an honor and a medal that's cherished by that service member and their families, but sometimes they get lost. Illinois Treasurer Michael Frericks is in charge of unclaimed property throughout the state, and he's on a mission to reunite families with these lost medals. He's here with me in our studios in Urbana. Also on the line with me from Peoria is a resident who was reunited with her father's Purple Heart last year, Connie Barnes. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
And Treasurer Frericks, welcome back.
Happy to be back here. This is a special time of the year. Very excited to talk about Memorial Day and to hopefully return more medals.
Connie, let's start with hearing your story. Your father fought in World War II. Didn't he talk about that time very much with you?
Not at all. What we knew was that he was in World War II. We knew that he had been in Germany and that he had served his country, but beyond that, had no idea of the type of service that he had provided or that he had earned the distinction of receiving a Purple Heart.
And how did, now that you've learned a little bit of the story, how did he earn his Purple Heart?
Well, we know he was wounded. We know that he was in Germany the day after D-Day, that he was in Normandy. We don't know exactly how he was wounded. That story never has come out. But we do know that he was in the thick of things during the Normandy invasion, but not there on actual D-Day.
And Connie, so you didn't even know that he had received a Purple Heart before the Treasurer's Office called you?
I did not.
What was it like when you got that call?
I was in my office at work, and I started crying. It was like getting a piece of my father back that I had lost a long time ago. It was still emotional for me to talk about, but the work that the State Treasurer's Office is doing in reuniting people with a part of their family's past and the service that they provided, my gratitude goes out to his office. I would have never known this without their diligence in trying to hunt down family members, and so I'm eternally grateful to their office for doing that.
That's Connie Barr on the line from Peoria telling us about how she found out about her father's Purple Heart. Illinois Treasurer Michael Frericks is in studio with me here in Urbana. Treasurer, how long has the state been doing this?
Well, we've done unclaimed property for 60 years. But when I came in, we had a display case with a lot of these military medals, and it was a beautiful display case. And I asked the question, I said, well, who do they belong to? And they said, well, they were turned over to us. I said, we made every effort to return them. And we really started, the first year I came in office, returning these medals. In the last year and a half, we've returned 5 Purple Hearts. And the story Connie just told is exactly why we do this, because you know it's their honor. It's their family. It doesn't belong to the state. Belongs to her family, and Connie will probably also tell you that she's not going to have this mistake happen again. He may not have wanted to tell his story, but she's going to make sure that his legacy is preserved and other people are aware of his valor.
So do you have to do a little bit of detective work here? How are you finding these families?
So, yes, that's a great example. I tell people I deputized one of my staff members to be a private investigator. To find that name, many of these medals, the person has passed away, but we try and track down their loved ones. And thank you to the internet and to Google and public record searches. It takes a little while to track some people down, and sometimes it's very difficult to get them to believe us. We've reached out to some families, and, you know, Connie was great. Here, some people say, this must be a scam. I'm not talking
to you.
But,
Connie, you thought it was a scam also when they first called. I would think that, too.
I was very skeptical in the beginning, but Lee at the treasurer's office he did a good job of convincing me that this was real.
And how do these medals get lost?
Well, these are valuable medals, and people put them in safe deposit boxes. And as Connie just said, a lot of these people who served their country, who were injured, don't tell their story. They don't talk about it. Connie's father's story is not unique. We've returned medals to people, and their family members said he still won't talk about what happened in Vietnam. Or he never came back and never mentioned this. So they're put in a safety deposit box, and if they don't tell their loved ones, no one claims them after they pass away, they come into our possession. Now, we'll auction off items that come in our possession if after 10 years we can't find the owners, but military medals are one thing that we will never auction off. You can't auction off honor. They earn that, and we keep trying. We'll hold on to it until we can find the recipient or their loved ones.
And so part of this, you've come on the program in the past, Treasurer, and you've talked about signing up for unclaimed property. Connie, is that something you started to do that? Is that that's part of the story of how the Treasurer's Office also found you, right?
It is. I had some training through my work at the bank, and I went out and tried it so that I could help customers, and I put in enough information to know that there was something out there but didn't really know what it was. And it was through that the Treasurer's Office was able to find me. I put enough information. I had my cell phone in there, and they were able to contact me.
And Connie, you actually had a couple of other things that were unclaimed property that also you were reunited with during this process.
Absolutely. I didn't realize that I had a couple of other things out there, and through this process, I was able to provide the necessary documentation and actually received a check for some stock that I had out there, and so that was just a bonus to this.
So, Treasurer Ferks, how does this work? When these safety deposit boxes eventually, do they get turned over to the Treasurer's Office, and then you have someone whose job is to go through all of this stuff?
Yeah, if they're abandoned, if their lease is up and the bank can hold on to it for 5 years trying to track down the owners, after 5 years they can't find them, they turn them over to us. We log them, all the contents, and then we put this information online. We don't put everything online, and that's why Connie couldn't see exactly what was there. She's right to be skeptical. There are identity thieves out there, and we find them trying to claim other people's property all the time. So if we put every bit of information online, people could build profiles. We want to stop that. But we give enough information that you get a little bite, and then they reach out to us, prove who they are, and we are very happy to return these.
And how do you verify that it's that person?
So provide proof of address. In the case of family members, you find a will or some sort of probate record. We've got a lot of things we do, and there are people reluctant to turn over information to us. And sometimes they will be upset that, hey, this is my property. Why is it so difficult? And I said, I know people are angry, and it takes a little while to get what belongs to them. But they're a whole lot angrier when we give it away to the wrong person. So we just want to verify we have a process to do that.
And Connie, you had to do that. Did you have to, I imagine, show your birth certificate, other information to prove that that you were related to your dad?
Sure, absolutely I did. Courthouse helped. Actually, someone from the Treasurer's Office stopped by Fulton County and picked up a copy of my mother's death certificate. And so they were very helpful in helping me get this. But yeah, there was a fair amount of documentation, but there were records and we were able to provide that.
Treasurer Ferks, how many medals do you still have?
We have over 100 medals out there. And so I love having Connie tell this story because it's a great story as we approach Memorial Day weekend. However, we also tell this story so that we know there might be other family members out there who know that they had a loved one with medals and perhaps they've lost track of them. Hopefully they'll go to illinoistreasurer.gov and put their name in and see if we have something that belongs to them. Or maybe in the case of one of the Purple Hearts we returned, it wasn't in the recipient's name, it was in his mother's name. So you might need to check various permutations out there to see, but if you have a loved one who served our country, who earned some sort of distinction, and you have lost track of those medals, come to our website and see maybe if we have it.
And you even have, do you have medals from the Civil War?
Well, we have discharge papers from the Civil War. We have artifacts from the Civil War from World War I and II, Korea, Vietnam, various conflicts out there. And these are people who served our country. And especially as we approach a holiday like Memorial Day, this is a time to stop and honor them and to try and track them down and get them to their loved ones.
Has this changed how you think about Memorial Day?
Very much so. I mean, it was always something that I participated in. But when you talk to these family members and you hear a story like Connie's where, you know, this person served his country, was injured, and then didn't talk about it, you know, that's a true hero. That is leadership. It's not about everyone look at me, but it's selfless sacrifice, and it's that kind of stuff that we should really take some time and honor. I know everyone talks about Memorial Day being the start of summer and, oh, I get a 3-day weekend, but I hope that everyone listening takes some time this weekend to think about the people who have sacrificed so that we can enjoy our freedoms.
Connie, how about you? How it is this last Memorial Day was when you were reunited. Well, you were actually, because you were introduced to this medal. How has this changed how you think about Memorial Day?
It's changed it significantly. I, like a lot of Americans, thought it was the start of summer and a holiday weekend, but I do take stock now of what my dad did and the hero that he was and the sacrifices of all the men and women who serve our country and protect us every day. I really have a deep and new appreciation for what all of them do to protect us.
And Connie, I know your father passed away when you were pretty young and you're his only living relative left. What does it mean for you to have his Purple Heart now?
Well, it's a piece of him that I didn't know existed. And so after him being gone for so long, it just rekindles and makes me remember how much I love him and still think about him every day. But it also gives me just another piece of his history and our family history that I didn't have before. And for that, I will always be grateful. I would have never known. I would have never had this piece of history without your office and without Lee's help. And so I will always be grateful for your office for championing this process.
Lee is the guy I deputized to be a private investigator. He has done a phenomenal job here with scant information. We were lucky that you entered that cell phone number when you search for unclaimed property, because sometimes it is really difficult to track people down. But I'll share a story with Connie that you reminded me of. We called one woman because we had found a policy that her father had, a life insurance policy. And we told her, were you aware your father had a life insurance policy? She said, well, I had no idea. I said, well, he did. I think it was $10,000. And she starts crying. I wonder, like, you know, what's going on here? Ma'am, are you okay? She said, well, yes. You know, I was always so close to my father. And we're approaching the 10-year anniversary of his death. And I was thinking how much I missed him. And when you told me that he had a life insurance policy for me, it's like he just came down from heaven and gave me a hug and that he's still looking after me, even in death. And like the person on our end of the line starts crying. They're crying to each other. And and you said like it's a surprise, but it's a chance to sort of, you know, reconnect with your dad.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yep.
So it's stories like this is why we do this and why we put so much effort into it. Connie, I want to thank you for sharing the story. As I said, it's a good story. But two, we know there'll be listeners out there throughout the state who will hear this and may actually go to a keyboard and look. And if your story helps us return a few more medals, then this will be very much worth it.
I agree. It's a great opportunity for me to, you know, tell my dad's story, but it's also a great opportunity to have others be able to have the same feeling I had. And if my story helps them do that, I'm happy to do it.
It's Connie Barr from Peoria telling us about her story and her family's story around this Memorial Day. I want to thank Illinois Treasurer Michael Furix for being with us as well. We will tweet out all the information about this and have it at our website at 21stshow.org. But both of you, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nyla.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.